So today, as I said, we're going to be looking at the book of Isaiah, but before we do that, I want to take a minute just to talk about Epiphany. Now, we've kind of talked about it a little bit before, but just a quick reminder. The season of Epiphany is, it's not like, oh, God had such a good idea. Like, let's talk about this wonderful idea God had. Instead, it's this revelation, this epiphany of God unto the Gentiles. And so Epiphany is set off by the reading in Matthew where the three magi, well, not three, sorry, the magi, come and they come to worship Jesus. And what that is, it's this incredible moment when God's love is being made manifest, not just to a specific bloodline, to the Israelites, but it's being made known to all the earth. And that's kind of the idea of Epiphany. And so it's grounded really in Christmas. It's grounded in the incarnation, that God looks upon his broken creation and says, this will not do. I must step into this. I'll take on flesh. And so Jesus comes onto the scene, God in the flesh, and then Jesus makes himself known to everybody in creation is the idea. And from there, this plan of salvation starts to unfold as Christ works out salvation when he dies and is raised again and makes this promise that he's going to come back, that the salvation work isn't done yet. Even right now, as we sit here on the other side of the resurrection, things are still not right. They're not the way they're supposed to be. And so we're waiting for Christ to come back and bring the full salvation that we have promised. And so in this season of Epiphany, this God making himself known to us and us waiting on him to come back, we read this interesting little section in the book of Isaiah. And so, first off, if you're ever looking for really great names, just look in your Old Testament. You have so many wonderful things. So if you got a child or a friend that has a child, just like some excellent examples here. Verse 4, you could go with forsaken or desolate. My delight is in her. That's a little wordy for my taste, so married. There's some just really excellent naming advice in the Old Testament. But it's actually really cool what's going on. And this entire section, I joke about it, but it's a really neat section because it's showing the love of God to a people who very likely may have given up on it. And a people who very definitely had certainly given up on following God in the first place. So Isaiah is a really striking book. I don't know if you know much about the context of the book of Isaiah, but it's a book written to a people who are not behaving well. Chapter 1 of Isaiah actually begins with this incredible rebuke of the people of God in which God, through Isaiah, says, I don't even want you to worship me anymore or sacrifice to me because you are doing such an abysmal job of showing basic love and decency to your neighbors, and you worshiping false idols. And from there, it goes on, and we have this incredible condemnation of the people of God, where he says, you have gone so far from me. You have no love for one another, and you worship these false gods. I'm going to send you away to Babylon, and I'm going to exile you. But then, in this incredible book of Isaiah, there's this turn in which suddenly we learn that this whole exile process wasn't meant to be just a giant rebuke saying, you're done, I'm done with you, but it's sending the people away as a reminder that they need God, that they need to continue to confess and believe in Yahweh God, who has made himself known and who has redeemed them time and time again. And that's where this little section of Isaiah is. It's spoken as a reminder to a people in exile that God has not abandoned them, that he has not forsaken his people, even when they think he has. And so verse 1, for Zion's sake, I will not keep silent, and for Jerusalem's sake, I will not be quiet until her righteousness goes forth as brightness and her salvation as a burning torch. It's incredible. The people of God have shown an utter inability to be loving and compassionate and faithful. And yet God doesn't quit on them. And so what we see here is not God saying, I'm going to give you another chance, people. I'm going to give you another chance to act righteous. I'm going to give you another chance to experience salvation. Instead, God puts the weight on himself. And he puts the responsibility on what he will do. And for Jerusalem's sake, I will not be quiet until her righteousness goes forth as brightness. That God is saying that he's going to be doing the salvation. That through him, these people will be made holy. These people will be claimed as his own. The nations shall see your righteousness and all the kings your glory, and you shall be called by a new name that the mouth of Yahweh will give. Now, naming for us, I already kind of poked at this. Naming for us, we kind of get it, right? Like, has anybody asked you what your name means? Have you ever had that? I can see you. You can answer this question. Has anybody ever asked you what your name means? Okay, so some of us have had that experience. The others of you, come afterward, and I'll ask you what your name means if you feel left out. I'll do that for you. So we have, like, significance behind our names, but like, so my name means gift of God. It's actually the same name as Nathaniel, and if you really want to be bored, I can explain the Hebrew to you. It means gift of God. And my parents may have known that, and they may have cared about that, but it wasn't like they went in this very intentional process, because we don't typically do that. Whereas in this culture, naming is massive. You name as a significance for somebody, or you'll see name changes. For instance, if you read through the book of Genesis, you get these characters like Abram and Sarai, who later become Abraham and Sarah, or Jacob, who becomes Israel or Israel. That all of those names have significance. For instance, Jacob is, anybody here named Jacob? Okay, sorry, Jacob. Jacob is the usurper, the crooked one, the thief. And so Jacob is a really interesting name. And the reason why Jacob's named that is because he comes out holding on, trying to steal the first birth position from his twin brother. But then later on, he's renamed Israel. And Israel actually has a double meaning, and one of the meanings is it's the one who is made straight. That Jacob, the crooked one, becomes the one who's been made straight. And that's a salvific renaming, that God is saying, I have claimed you as my own. I have renamed you this. And so when God says, I will give you a new name, you will no longer be called, jumping down to verse 4, forsaken and desolate. It's God saying, I'm giving you a new name. I'm taking away this character and this attribute that you have shown time and again to turn away from me, and I give you a new name that means life and hope and salvation, that you will be married. And the bridegroom here is God, that God marries his people, and even when they don't deserve it, that he might give them salvation that they have not earned, that they have not taken for themselves. And so God, in verse 3, you shall be a crown of beauty in the hand of the Lord and royal diadem in the hand of your God. It's this incredible thing in which the king of all creation, who made everything, wants to make a crown. But he doesn't tell us, hey, I want you to turn yourself into a nice crown. He doesn't, you know, call up his local blacksmith and say, I need some jewelry made. He does the work. He's the one who makes us beautiful and whole. He's the one who washes us. That Isaiah, as he talks about this, he's certainly talking about the work that God was doing in the lives of the exiles as he was reclaiming the people of Israel. But he's also talking about our lives as well, that we are a people of God who have been made holy through the sacrifice of Christ, and that God is constantly working to make that love known, that he constantly wants us to have this epiphany, that we would understand who Jesus is, not just that we would be able to say, oh yes, Jesus is the Son of God, but that we would trust and believe that Christ died for us, that we do nothing to bring about our own salvation, that God does all of this work and he gives it to us freely, and that we would take heart and confidence in this. And so we have no part in our salvation, but as verse 2 helps us understand, we do have part in revealing that salvation. Remember, the book of Isaiah doesn't begin with, you've all been really bad, but that's fine. I don't care. Begins with, you've all been really bad, and that's not okay. You should be showing lives of love for your neighbor. You should be showing lives that show love for God. And so when Christ makes us righteous, he asks us to reveal that righteousness and to show that righteousness to those around us. That the season of Epiphany is not just God making himself known to us, but it's God making himself known through through us as well, that we are part of this unfolding thing of God making himself known to all nations. So verse 2, jumping back to that, the nations shall see your righteousness and all the kings your glory, and you shall be called by a new name that the mouth of the Lord will give. That the idea is that the salvation that we've been given is a salvation that others will see and experience through us and through our actions and through our speech. And so we are part of this epiphany, that God makes himself known to us, and now we, grounded in that salvation, grounded in that love that we have, trusting that God is love and that he has cared for us, we turn around and we share that compassion and love with others, that they too might experience this epiphany of God and hold on to him and love and salvation. And we reflect his righteousness, which he gave to us. And so when we say blessed epiphany, or as we go through the season of epiphany, it's this double-edged sword that we see that Christ makes himself known to us, and now we want to make him known to others, that we would be part of this unfolding epiphany. Amen.